Now, I like to buy things on eBay. I don't know about you, but I don't always like to pay full price for something. So I find if you go on eBay, you can get like a knockoff version of something for like a fraction of the cost, and I am a big fan of that. But because I buy things that are so cheap off eBay, quite often the shipping costs more than the actual item itself. So I'm not interested in paying for the extra shipping. Because when I'm buying some gadget that costs $3, $17 to make it ship in 3 days seems a bit ridiculous. So I will wait. And two things happen when I wait for things to arrive from eBay. One, which is the most regular, I get annoyed at waiting because I get tired of waiting. And the other one is I wait for so long I forget that I ordered something, and then when it turns up I'm surprised and it's like a present and I'm kind of like, oh cool, that's nice. Which I guess shows you just how much I don't need the gadgets that I buy off eBay. I don't know about you and what you're hoping for this year, but as we look towards this year with this little series, last week we were challenged with the idea of keeping our eyes fixed on Jesus, knowing that he will return. And we know he will return. But waiting can be tough. Keeping our eyes fixed on Jesus is all well and good in theory. We know we should do that. But is that all we do? And what does that look like? How do we do it? How do we keep our eyes fixed on Jesus? This passage in James talks of awaiting the Lord's return. And how do we do that? Because waiting, as we know, can be boring. And waiting can be tough. Sometimes the hardest thing about waiting is you don't actually know how long you're waiting for. I've experienced this before, I'm sure you have, when someone tells you they're 5 minutes away and you wait. So let's read today's passage if you've got it there in front of you, James 5, 7 to 12. Be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. Above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no, otherwise you will be condemned. We get some great insights from James here as to what it means to wait for the coming of the Lord. Firstly, we are told to wait patiently. Verses 7 to 9 say, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Patience is the key word in this passage. It pops up 3 times. And I don't know much about farming. It's one of the things that I don't know about, one of the many things. But the great thing about farmers and the small amount of time I've spent in Makkah is that they don't really care if you don't know about farming. They'll still tell you about it, and all you have to do is nod and say yes at the correct time, and they'll just keep telling you about how their crops are going. The only thing I do know is that you can't call a paddock a field. They get a bit upset when you do that. But even if I don't know much about farming, and you might not know much about farming, it's easy to know that if there is rain, stuff will grow. And if there is not rain, things probably aren't going to grow very well. And what James encourages the reader with here is to think of the farmer who knows that the rain will fall. He waits for the land to produce a crop, but it cannot be done without the rainfall that is needed. And this crop is everything to the farmer. Without it, there is no livelihood. there is no source of income, so the farmer will wait because he doesn't have any other choice. And James says we must be like this farmer, patient. He also says to stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. Now, what does this mean, to stand firm? I think quite often we read passages like this and we think of persecution. Stand firm in tough times. Stand firm for the hard times we'll endure for being a Christian. Stand firm when people make fun of your faith. Stand firm when people try to bring you down or anything like that. But in my experience, I think this is actually different. I think it's a bit different to that. I think stand firm on the belief you have is meaning here that even though something might look a whole lot more fun, stand firm on your faith. Stand firm in your faith even though your friends are out there doing things that they don't seem to be getting into any trouble for, but you get told that they're not the right things to do. Stand firm because that person who has devoted their life to work seems to have a whole lot of money, and money is nice because money can buy things. Stand firm because that person over there seems really happy with their life and the things they are doing seem to be working really well for them and they seem to be really pleased and having a great time. Why can't I have all of that as well? I think what James is saying here is essentially be patient, and while you wait, make sure your heart is right. Be patient, and as you wait for the return of the Lord, keep working on those things in your life that are maybe causing you to not stand so firm. Keep your eyes fixed on Jesus, knowing that those things around you, while they look fairly enticing and they look exciting and they look grand and wonderful, they will not satisfy. Not like the love of Christ. Now, as you know, in February we are bringing the church together for a month. Now, that's not so that we can feel good about ourselves and say, look how many people we can fit in the church at 10 a.m. It's so that we can work together to see how we can all be standing firm. On the first Sunday afternoon, we'll have a church picnic together so that we can get to know each other better. We can spend time with the members of the 9:30 gathering. We can spend time with people from the 4 p.m. gathering. We can build new relationships. We can build friendships. We can chat to each other. And we can stand firm together. Because it's a whole lot easier to stand firm when you're standing with others. When you know there are other people standing for the same thing you're standing for, it's a whole lot easier to stand firm. It says, you too, be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. What does patience look like for you? What does it mean to patiently have your eyes fixed on Jesus? And what does it mean to stand firm? For the farmer, there can be all the rain in the world, but if he hasn't prepared a crop, the rain is useless to him. Likewise, we can be patient, but if we are not standing firm on something, then what's the point of waiting patiently? And what are we waiting patiently for that will really matter? Might as well head off and do something else. It's like waiting at a bus stop for a bus for 2 or 3 hours, and then when the bus rolls up, deciding you don't want to jump on it. Why did you spend the 2 or 3 hours waiting if you weren't going to take what's there when it arrives? Verse 9 sort of seems off on its own a little bit, but in this context it fits really nicely. It says this, don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Have you ever been waiting for someone and they are late? And not like 5 minutes late, like a fair amount of time late, you know, 20, 30 minutes late. How does it feel? What do you start thinking about that person? Are you really positive towards them? Are you thinking, gee, I love that they're running late. That's really helpful for me and what my plans are for the day. I was late to work in the morning a little bit last year. I know, shock horror, Pat. It's hard to believe. But I decided I didn't want to be late anymore. I thought, you know what, getting to work on time, is some of the perks of working at a church. Like anywhere else, I'd get like in a whole lot of trouble. But Mike would just send little text messages like, coffee's on, or, you know, just waiting for you, little things like that. So I thought, you know what, I'm gonna get to work first. I'm going to get there before 9, and I'll put the coffee on. So for a short while, I managed to get into the office first, and it was going well. And then one day, I walked to work. I took Leif in the pram and I walked him to work. And I thought that was really cool because as my clock struck 9 a.m., I walked into the car park. And I just thought, I can't wait to get into the church so everyone can be so surprised that I managed to time my walk so perfectly that bang on 9 o'clock I walked in through the door. So I'm walking all chuffed to the door and it was locked and no one was here. And I was upset because I couldn't sort of show off the fact that I was on time. One morning, Mike rolled in at about 9:30. Half an hour late, and I was excited because it meant that I could let him know that he was late. So I put the coffee on at 9 o'clock, and at about 9:15, when I knew he was probably going to turn up late, I made a coffee for him so it'd get cold and I could be like, I made a coffee for you, Mike, and you didn't turn up. Now, after I'd finished giving him stick for being late, he said this. He said, so, sorry, but the two kids were sick at home, so Carolyn was looking after them, and I had to go and do the morning drop-off, drop the kids off to school. And I also had to go grab a couple of things from the shop so that Carolyn could stay at home with the two kids for the day. And I felt like a jerk. But I think that's why when James says, don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged, I think there's an element of us really being able to understand the fact that we are most annoyed when people are made, or when we're made to wait. When we're waiting for someone, when someone lets us down, when someone doesn't turn up, when someone's taking their time, that's when we're annoyed. I'm sure you can think of a time where you've been in that situation, because it's the easiest time to grumble and it's the easiest time to speak down while we are waiting. Now, in this context, James is talking to the church about waiting patiently together for Christ's return. So what does that mean for us and the way that we speak about each other? What does that mean for us and the way that we talk about each other when we're in small groups? What does it mean for us and the way we talk about other Christians? Are we grumbling against one another as we wait for Christ because we think they're not doing it the same way as we are? That they're not doing it the right way or the way that we would be? Again, as we go into February, we'll have a chance to all gather together. And there are things you can grumble about. I have no doubt about that at all. There's things you can grumble about. But there are also some great things you can talk about. You can meet new people. You can build new friendships. All while waiting together and standing firm. We'll be spending our second Sunday with an opportunity to have someone over from church for lunch or be invited to someone's house for lunch. Now, I said to the morning service, and I'll say it to you guys as well, if you would really like to go to someone's house for lunch, like if there's a house here, like, gee, I'd love to see their house, you can ask them, can I come for lunch on the second weekend of February? I'm keen to see how that plays out. I'm gonna make sure we ask someone else before someone can ask us. But you have that opportunity to either have someone over for lunch or go to someone's for lunch or for dinner. And as you head there for lunch, you could quite easily groan and complain about all the things you wish were happening better, whether that's in this church or whether it's in Christianity in general. We could talk about how we would do it better. We could grumble and we could complain. Or we could stand firm. You know what bickering can do. You know what whinging can do. And you know that a lot of the time it actually looks quite fun, and it is a bit of fun. It's actually quite refreshing. But that's not standing firm. How in my patience of Christ's return do I play my part in preparing his bride? What does that look like? How in my waiting for Christ's return do I talk up my fellow Christians? How in my patience do I do something constructive maybe with some of the problems I have? Or how can I be a part of a team in bringing that forward? What does standing firm look like instead of grumbling? Verses 10 and 11 say, "Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy." Now, James assures us that we can find examples of patience through the Bible. And for whatever reason, he chooses to use Job as the example of someone who persevered, as someone who showed patience. Which is interesting because, as we know, Job grumbled a fair bit against God. So how does this differ to us grumbling about each other? I think James used Job as an example because no matter what the hardship was thrown at him, his faith in God never wavered. He stood firm. A theologian called William Barclay said this about Job: "Job's is no groveling, passive, unquestioning submission. Job struggled and questioned and sometimes even defied, but the flame of faith was never extinguished in his heart." That sounds to me like someone who might have been a bit tired of waiting, someone who was a bit frustrated by having to wait, but he pushed through nonetheless. It's sort of like when your friends or family still haven't turned up, and you're going, "Oh, I just wish they'd turn up. Just wish they'd be here because I'd like to get on with it." How do you respond to them when they turn up? Do you really remind them and let them know that they were late? Or do you say, "Hey, we're glad you're here," and embrace and get on with the night? I think this should comfort us to know that as we wait, questioning is okay, and struggling is okay, because that's essentially what we face every day. But our firm faith must be there. We know what we are waiting for. And with that knowledge, the final lines of verse 11 are really encouraging. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy, which is great news, but also the reason why we continue to wait patiently. We know that the Lord is returning, and we know his character. We know what we are waiting for. We know who we are waiting for. And it's worth it. Now, finally, we finish this passage with verse 12. "Above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no. Otherwise, you will be condemned." Now, I think this verse is pretty cool because it can stand alone. It can also stand to help finish off the next few verses. But it is also really great to tie off this idea. We've been told to be patient, for we know Christ is returning. We've also been told not to grumble and whinge and badmouth each other. And I think for this reason it makes sense to finish off with this idea of not swearing by heaven or earth or anything else, and that we simply say yes or no. Because swearing by something was often to say, "Trust me because I have to be right. I'm going to make this really outrageous call so you can believe me." The problem is, if you were lying, that's actually quite a big thing. And people start to pick up on that. And people start to believe you a little less every single time you say something. They start to trust you a little bit less every time you say something. And it doesn't matter what you swear by in the end, they're not really interested in listening to what you have to say. I also think swearing under God's name or heaven or something of God, that's what they would do, something like the altar. It would be seen as, wow, they cannot be lying. But James says, don't do it. He says, above all, almost as if if we badmouth God's name or we bring God's character into one of our lies, that's worse than the way that we speak to each other. And he follows that up with, all you need is a simple yes or no. That should be enough. If you are someone of integrity, a simple yes or a simple no will mean something when you say something. When you say, I'll be there in 5 minutes, people believe that. And they expect you there in 5 minutes. When you say, hey, I'm actually not going to be there in 5 minutes, I'm running late, I'm really sorry, it's going to be more like 20, that means something. I think James uses the yes and the no because it has always been a mark of respect and it's been a mark of someone's honour. Are they truthful with their words? Which, as followers of Christ, I actually think is a really important thing as we wait patiently and as we stand firm. Because we want to tell people the best news ever. We want to tell them about Jesus. We want to tell them about the gospel message and his saving power. And if people don't trust us, or if people don't think our word is worth anything, how do we share with them the great news? On the third Sunday of February, we'll gather together in the morning at 10 a.m., and then we'll be challenged to have someone over. But it'll look a bit different to the week before. We'll be inviting some people from our church, but mostly we'll be inviting our friends who aren't a part of church. We will have a bit of a party. You might want to play cub or cornhole. Maybe you want to do it down at the beach. But as you have those people around, those people who don't know Jesus, do they value your word? Do they value what you have to say? When you tell them that you're waiting patiently, you're standing firm in what you're waiting for, how do they respond to that? We're given some pretty big challenges in these five verses as we wait for Christ to return. While we wait, we should do it standing firmly on our faith, even if that is hard, even if that is difficult. And ideally, we do it together because we're all trying to stand firm. We're all trying to do the same thing. We should make sure that as we are waiting, we don't get mad at each other. Let's not badmouth or talk each other down. And that's not just the immediate here, but let's not talk down other Christians who are also waiting. Let's not talk down the other churches, the other denominations who are also trying to wait patiently and stand firmly on their faith. What does that say about us? Let's build each other up. Let's bring genuine questions or rebukes to the people. Let's chat to them. And finally, while we wait, we should make sure that when people ask us what we are waiting for, we have enough street cred or good standing that they might actually be interested in what we have to say. Now, as I said at the start, we will close this service off by praying. And it might come as a surprise to you, but I'm really looking forward to February because I think it's really going to be great. I think we have a great chance to see our church put a bunch of these things straight into action. But it really only works if we are prepared to buy in. So now, as we close off in prayer, I'd ask you to start thinking about who you could have over for lunch, or whose house you could go to for lunch. Who you would like to check in with to make sure that they're going to make it to the picnic. Who you could ring up to see, hey, is 10 o'clock going to be a tough time for you to get to church? Because I can take some notes for you if you're not going to be able to get along to the service, so that when you're listening back to the podcast, you can follow along some notes, because it would really make me sad if you missed out on all of what's going on. Maybe you could think about, who can I give a lift to so that we can make sure there's some spots in our car park? All of these things we do while we patiently wait. And all of those things are far more helpful than grumbling and complaining and whinging. All of those things are far more helpful than wishing that maybe it looked differently or I could stand firm on something else. So instead of me closing off now in prayer, what I'm going to invite you to do is just have some time to think about those things. Who can you invite? Who can it be? Because I think if we just sort of pick a name out of a hat and go, yeah, let's get them, that could be really cool, and maybe that's what you're thinking of doing. But I also think that if we let the Holy Spirit guide that, I think there could be some really great things. If we are silent now, or maybe you want to talk to your family as you pray, you could think about, hey, what would this look like for us? How are we going to make this work? So I'll invite you now as we close to just reflect, to pray, to think about some of those names, some of those people, and what it is you could be doing in February.